Culture eats strategy for lunch, and informed cultures drive decision, inspire action. At the Data Culture Podcast, we talk with execs, visionaries, and data experts so that you may move from idea to outcome in your own data culture journey. Welcome to the Data Culture Podcast. My name is Sid Atkinson, data culture innovator and consulting leader with over 21 years in data. With us today, and thanks for joining, is Jonathan Alexander. He leads AI and analytics efforts in manufacturing for the organization. Jonathan, exciting to have you on today.
Sid, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And Jonathan, I think there's a little bit, before we get to the first question, there's a little bit of a story on how you landed in this. So I think you wanted to share that before we jump into talking about pilot purgatory.
Yeah. My history is in manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And so right now I work in a global organization supporting manufacturing excellence. And we use AI and analytics to improve productivity at our manufacturing sites. But I started working in the shop floor with operators, with our maintenance technicians. I worked in maintenance and instrumentation. Mm-hmm. I worked in operations and our chemical plants. And I remember one of the times when I started as a process engineer, one of the things that we would do is at the site, there was this very wise and very smart old gentleman. His name was Guy.
Guy.
That was literally his name. His first name was Guy.
So you literally had a guy.
We literally had, it was not just a guy, it was the guy.
The guy. So,
yes.
So Guy was the guy.
He was legendary. He still is legendary. He no longer works for the company. But one of the things that we would do in manufacturing, we look at time series data. And mm-hmm. so this is temperatures, pressures, flows. And it's not, when you look at it over, maybe we're collecting the data every second or every 2 mm-hmm. seconds or 3 seconds. And so you look at how your process, your manufacturing process is changing over time. Mm-hmm. And some of our sites have 50,000 instruments. And so the guy, he was responsible for these 50,000 instruments and the process and all the operators and the ship supervisors and the foreman. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that you did as a new process engineer is you had to go to what they called the Guy School of Trends. And so a process trend, like I said, is maybe you have 5 to 10 pressures, temperatures, flows on a screen, and you look maybe a 12 to 24 hour window about mm-hmm. trying to figure out how the process ran over the past shift or multiple shifts. And so what we would do is Guy for decades would get to the site at 5 a.m. And for 2 hours, he would search through one by one, all these process trends, probably going through must have been maybe 1,000 instruments, key instruments. So not all of the instruments, but had to have been 1,000 and also some Excel reports. But what he would do is for 2 hours, he had this notebook and he would write down all these hidden signals and patterns in the process that he thought were important. Mm-hmm. And then he would take that to the team. We call it the tailgate, where everybody gets together in the morning at 7 o'clock. And you try to figure out what problems happened over the last 24 hours. What should you focus your efforts on for the day? And Guy was just really great at kind of teaching everybody this process. So I had to be there for maybe a couple of weeks. I would get there at 5 a.m. and I would sit there in his office for 2 hours learning this process. How do you find all these different patterns and mm-hmm. signals? What's important? And then one of the things that he would do is he would teach everybody that. After a while, after I got through the Guy School of Trends, all the training, what I would do is I have to get there at 6:30 a.m. And for 30 minutes before 7 o'clock, I would have to go through my own trend review and have mm-hmm. my own notebook of things I found. And everybody in the whole site that was responsible for these processes did that every day. And this happened for years. And so one of the things that would, when I started going through that, we started finding problems that started to be repeat occurrences. Mm-hmm. And we also realized that everybody is looking at the same data in mm-hmm. the same way, wasting our time. So maybe start to think there's got to be a better way. And over time, as we got exposed to more modern machine learning and AI technique, you started having those, find those automatically for you. Mm-hmm. So that's really what transformed and sparked my interest in data, AI, ML mm-hmm. is kind of from a selfish reason. It was just trying to not have to get to work at 6:30 a.m. So I could wake up 30 minutes later and roll into the site at 7 and start my day. But that's kind of how I begun my journey with AI and data, and it's crazy to think where we are today. But that was probably maybe about 10 years ago that I started that process. And yeah, the sites are wildly different now.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the old adage is that like laziness breeds innovation, right? And I think that underserves like the motivation. It's not necessarily that we're lazy, I think, because if you truly were lazy, then you might just try to get out of that work versus try to improve it. I think it's the fact that the vast majority of humans get bored with doing things like that over and over. And so then when you see both have the knowledge that this could be different and find ways to be, have it be different, which then gets into this next thing. And hey, now we got to have things be different. We have to pilot things.
Right.
Jonathan, one of the things that helped make your career over there at Albemarle and why you have some expanded capabilities and responsibilities is that you started piloting things, but you've also then talked about the danger that people can get into if you don't ever get out of this pilot phase. So let's start with the big picture here, and then you've got some insights to share. But what exactly is pilot purgatory? And we can go into some of the common pitfalls that organizations run into. So how do you define pilot purgatory? I think when you say that term, most people are going to get what it means.
Yeah.
But, let's expand on it a bit. What is that to you?
Well, I guess first have to think about what is a pilot. Yep. And it's probably very simple, but I think it helps frame up the following is what is pilot purgatory. But the whole point of a pilot typically is to test something, and you're preparing for something. And a lot of times what I see is that, at least in our industry, is that people will take a technology that they see that's new or sexy or exciting. And then they'll say, okay, we had this cool thing that we want to do. Let's go pilot it because it's the least amount of effort to just go ahead and get started. And those are great. And I would say if you're looking to scale and realize economies of scale from whatever AI or ML or data initiative that you're doing, you have to pilot because you don't want to just invest in something that maybe you're not 100% sure exactly how it's going to work.
Yeah.
But I think the challenge that people do is they don't pilot with the right purpose. And so they go first with the technology and then they just try to prove the technology. And then they sit there and they might find an application and have a quick win. And maybe they find a few, but then over time it becomes just unbelievably challenging to realize the economies of scale, the business value from it. And that's where people get held up. And so for us, I think it was not trying to, or switching from a technology-based vision to a relentless focus on business value.
Yes.
And so if you first focus on what problem am I trying to solve, and then find the right technology, and then you use that technology to then first pilot it to solve that problem. And the whole purpose of the pilot should be not only just to test the technology, but test that you can actually solve that business problem. And then the other purpose of a pilot is to prepare the scope of work for a global, broader issue or program. And so you shouldn't be piloting and have the pilot be the endpoint.
Yeah. Yep. I think that one of the nomenclatures that we've used with clients, and sometimes they stick around and keep it, but like in that same vein that you're talking, switching pilot from being something technical to being business value focused, which then helps, like if the business case for the pilot, to your point, is declared, then it's more likely once we get those initial business success conditions that people are going to feel motivated to keep going and get support that initiative. But one of the things we've talked to a lot of folks is then when there's still very valid reasons the tech team needs to look, will this thing work? I don't know all the different use cases, but I need to know, will this thing work? Well, that's a POC. Tech teams do POCs to make sure before they go to the business teams to advise on, hey, I've got something that might work for district X, Y, and Z. I don't know your priorities, but tell me your priorities, but I'm going to bring you an idea on tech that works. That's a POC. Pilots should always have business, in Sid's view of the world, Lee's view of the world, pilots should have business value attached. So now, couldn't agree more with what you're saying.
I haven't actually heard it differentiated. Because like when you said POV, as you were explaining,
POC, was, proof of concept, POC, sorry, POC, yeah. Yeah.
I was thinking, I guess POV, which is maybe proof of value, being the same thing, pilots, POCs, and I think you're right. It's they are different, and it's easier to start with a proof of concept because you don't have to do the business case.
Yep.
And this gets back to, we're big users in Lean and Six Sigma in manufacturing. And one of the Six Sigma techniques for improving a process, and this works in manufacturing, works in healthcare. They do Six Sigma in finance, lots of programs. But the very first step, they have a 5-step process to improvement called the DMAIC process. So the first step is define.
Yep.
Then you measure, then you analyze, then you improve, and then you should control and sustain that improvement. And what I find, and I've been guilty of this many times in the past, is that engineers or technical people, they want to just jump right into the analysis step and maybe the measure phase, but they like to skip the define section where you're defining the business problem, you're aligning on your stakeholders, you're validating the economics and finding a single target or KPI or selection of KPIs that you're going to try to improve. And then the whole following chain across that improvement process is trying to realize that very beginning business case.
Yeah. And correct me, because it's been ages since I had my little Six Sigma handbook and did it. But if I remember this correctly, like the first two phases, define and measure, are supposed to be cyclical, right? You'd start with a hypothesis, then you go seek the measures. And then if your measures don't inform your hypothesis, you're supposed to go back and redefine.
That's right.
So if you don't, if you skip that step, you can be very busy, but not towards the good, the right purpose. But yeah, those early phases were intended to be cyclical so that as then you look to improve something, you know you're going to be on the right path.
And we find that working, so we actually combine Six Sigma techniques with the modern AI and ML techniques to, I guess, modernize or expedite the process for our ability to execute those improvement projects and efforts. And just like on the technology side with Pilot Purgatory, we find it on the improvement side is that people love to just jump in and start solving the problem.
Yeah.
And I'm from Texas, and so we're a bunch of gunslingers and we
duct tape and baling wire.
Oh yeah, yeah. I like to say duct tape and chicken wire and WD-40. All those are key for us over here.
Yeah, just put some Windex on it.
That's right.
Yeah. All right, so then I love the definition of Pilot Purgatory. And by the way, for everybody listening, we did not get a chance to talk about that alignment on pilot versus POC, which is that happened very naturally here. But then the other side is then you talk about that fragmented technology leading to fragmented results. What does it look like? Because y'all had been hinted at this earlier. It's like when data is hard, when you don't have that information and you've been, Albemarle's been on this journey, you've been on this journey in unifying these things. What was the state before? You hinted at a little bit when you talked about Guy, and what's the journey that you've been on? Like, how does we go from fragmented results, fragmented data, fragmented tech, and fragmented results to where you're a little more unified? And nobody's all the way there, but you've been on a journey of improvement. So walk us through that. Yeah.
So, well, I'll give another, it's not a personal story, but maybe an analogy that can work. So thinking about like my time as a process engineer, how I observe some of our process engineers in the past, I think about them hunting for those signals and those trends for 30 minutes every morning, or maybe some of them 2 hours, depending on your role. And I'm not a morning person. So that was a tough time for me personally, but I think about them when you think about data being the new gold, I'm a big believer of that. And I always draw the analogy to our engineers sometimes in the past have been like those old gold miners.
Yeah.
They're sitting waist deep in a freezing cold riverbed. They're shifting through all this mud for, I don't know, 12 to 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. And for maybe once a week, they get a small gold flake. And they know that there's like maybe lots of gold buried deep down underneath the surface, but they just don't have the infrastructure or the resources to kind of get after it.
Yeah.
That was a realization from our part is we needed to provide the right infrastructure. So that was really the basis of our big global program, which we branded AI and we marketed as Albemarle Intelligence.
Yeah. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. And that was before the big Gen AI hype thing. We did this in 2019 was when we started that. But one of the things is that in order to provide that right infrastructure, the goal was to basically bring that ore to surface and provide it in a common playing field and access to anybody. And then what you had to do is set up all these different refining and processing steps to further refine that gold and then deliver it to your customers.
Yeah.
And for us, our customers were the operators and engineers on the front lines making decisions about our process, trying to improve productivity or improve quality or efficiencies. And so when we think about fragmenting technology, we were all over the place. Like you had all these gold miners, so to speak, basically, you know, wading in different rivers and shifting with different devices and getting gold at different rates.
Yeah.
And so we basically provided at each of our manufacturing sites this massive infrastructure. And we use a software called the PI system from a company called Aviva. And they collect all the data from our instruments. But one of the things that was missing is the contextualization of that data.
Yeah.
So that was the first priority for us is how do we contextualize the data that we do have? So for example, we would have a, let's say you had a flow meter. The flow meter would be defined as FE, which stands for flow element, but FE 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And you have 100,000 instruments like this and they would, you would be collecting them. And like I said, they're taking measurements every 2 or 3 seconds, sometimes 5 seconds, 10 seconds. But that was it. That was the only information that you had with that. And you had to look on the trend to see, to really get any information, or you had to pull all that data into Excel and then you had to manipulate it. But the information about that flow meter, which is very important for our process, there was no contextualization around, no metadata associated with it. You didn't know what exact piece of equipment that was part of. So what you had to do
Was it in the chain or anything
exactly.
like that?
Exactly. And so what you had to do is you had to go through all these piles of P&IDs, which are like design documents of the plant, to find that flow meter and then trace it back. Oh, it's next to this tank and the material stream that is feeding through it is this material. So went all in on metadata. And that was probably for the first couple of years, probably 80% of our effort is contextualizing our data and providing this extra layer of metadata and custom curating that data to feed all of our downstream analytical solutions. So our goal was to basically get a unified data set around each of our major processes. And so we called this goal the Unobtainium data set.
Somebody is an Avatar fan.
Yes, a little bit of an Avatar reference. And so the goal was Unobtainium, which means imagine that whatever type of analysis that you need, that you're going to do, whatever ML or LLM solution that you're going to use, you're going to have to get your data and imagine that your data is in the perfect format. It's in the perfect time range. It has all of the relevant metadata associated, all of the relevant pieces of instrumentation or other information. And then you just press the go button on your ML algorithm. And so that was like the vision of imagine this Unobtainium, this perfect data set, and work your way backwards. How do we get there? And so we've been on that journey for a very long time. And it's pretty incredible once you make that big investment on that contextualization layer and you have data formatted in the right way, how rapidly you're able to do your downstream analytics. So we're at a point now where we can go into a process after we properly contextualize it and we can build a machine learning model in less than 1 hour, and we can actually operationalize that, and we can deliver it to the manufacturing shop floor all within 1 hour.
Yeah.
And that can be a variety of different types of machine learning models, but they can be on hundreds of variables. And traditionally, before that contextualization layer, that process took probably a month.
Yeah. Now, I think there's a lot of things to unpack in what you just said there, and I don't want to gloss over those for our listeners, because I think, so two bits. Let's start with what the first one. So when you look at fragmented data systems and data technology, one of the first hurdles that y'all overcame here, and let's not gloss over this hurdle, but we see it over and over. There is a fear typically in the organization that when, oh gosh, if I'm going to bring all my data into the same place and let many people have access to it, that's a problem.
Right.
You don't know how many people are accessing your data today in all the different spaces. We're talking about now putting it all in the same space. So I imagine even if people were excited about that, y'all still had to overcome some measure of organizational resistance to, now we want to defragment our data, bring it all into one place and make it usable. So before we get to the second piece, that was brilliant. Let's talk about that one. How did y'all get through, or was there any organizational resistance to pulling all the data together in one spot?
I think there wasn't organizational resistance, I think, to the vision of,
yeah,
imagine that you have a perfect data set and you can do machine learning at your fingertips.
Yeah.
I think everybody was fairly aligned with that. Now, when you got into the how, that's where you had some misalignment on, or challenges, because people have different opinions on the technology stack and the data pipeline and the method of how you're going to do that.
Yeah.
And then specifically, there was a lot of difference of opinions on the organization and resource structure that's going to support that type of effort.
Yeah.
And there's lots of different strategies that you can go. You can build it all 100% custom in-house and hire a bunch of data scientists and data programmers. You can 100% import this solution. And so you can hire somebody to do it all for you. And then there's all these different levels and layers of gray in between. So I think we fell probably somewhere in the middle, but lots of different opinions on that spectrum.
Yeah. So you first had to wrangle. So good thing was people were aligned on it. And we actually see that a lot, is people get aligned on it, but then that's so that the detractors can say yes, but then blame the process, the tech or the tools on why it doesn't work.
Yeah.
So yeah, but so you had to do some wrangling to get a platform that you could use to basically defragment the knowledge and the data in the enterprise first. That was step one.
Of course, we have a lot of challenges on security is a big thing for us and very important. And it's really challenging. We call in the manufacturing side, if you're at the manufacturing site, we call that the OT network or operational technology. And then if you're on the business side, you have the IT. And so the bridge between IT and OT is complicated.
Yeah.
And I think that is, has always, that's a big concern in our industry and has been a challenge for us. Now, we partnered very well with IT, but a lot of things that we wanted to do were, I'm maybe on the functional side, trying to create business value, and on the data user side, and my responsibility is not security. So
yeah,
security is important for me, but to be honest, I just want, we always tend to want everything instantaneously and give us access to everything. And we don't want to have to come and answer to anybody. And that's just not realistic. So that was a big challenge for us, is trying to say, here's our big vision for where we want this data, but also balancing the needs and concerns and the risk management around cybersecurity.
Oh, yeah. I get it. It's like when you have something that works in manufacturing, you don't really want to mess with it, which means sometimes that machine is controlled by a device that's running Windows 8.
Yeah.
Or 2000, Windows 2000. It's like sometimes that just, that's what that means, right? And that, and yes, of course, like IT should be very concerned about the perimeter and the security of that device, because now you're dealing with legacy operating systems that have no support, no patching whatsoever. And like, probably as we've seen in the past, they have to have all the ports open for all communication from all points in time so that they can do their job.
Yeah. So it's really, like, I'm not an expert in OT security or the IT/OT landscape, but it's a pretty big challenge because a lot of our manufacturing sites, like you talked about Windows 7 or Windows 8. Now I started to think about, that'd be pretty nice to have Windows 7 or Windows 8 on some of those. In the manufacturing space, if you have a plant that was built in the 1970s or 50s or any kind of time in between here and then, you probably have some processes that are running on systems that haven't had a major upgrade since the 1990s or 1980s. And think about, I got my first family computer in 1995. It was a Windows 1995.
Yeah.
We have some of our, there's some places in the manufacturing industry. Now, Albemarle, I think at this now we're kind of like, most of our control systems are more up to date.
Yep.
But I know some people in the industry still running things from the 1980s technology, and it's kind of scary. So you're trying to like, how do I do AI on that? So imagine doing, you know, building a large language model on top of Microsoft DOS or something.
To get to that, this is the other brilliant thing around. So one, you had to cast a vision that got people bought into the vision, and they made that vision compelling enough. People were willing to work through the blockers to come up with how are we going to have a unified data platform. So that was step one. But the other part, and this is also I think most people are familiar with that section of the journey. The other part, though, that you mentioned that is really important to highlight is something that some folks come to the realization after they've done step one, but y'all were tackling this as a 1-2, and that you already knew to get to the end state of this beautiful analysis, building machine learning models, being able to find the the gaps in the process or the ways to do improvement, that there was data that didn't exist in your systems, right? So you were starting to build the digital twin of your factory floors and saying, all right, you know what? The stuff that's in the plant diagrams doesn't exist in our data systems. So we already need to have a plan to get that in. As I said, contextualize FE-12345. Where is that? Is that before the boiler, after the boiler? Where is that flow meter? So that I know when I'm looking at the pressures on it or the readouts on it, that I understand what's happening and where the potential is like for the error, or is everything fine? So y'all recognize data gaps and knew the end state on the analysis you wanted to do so that you could start to address those gaps. What were learnings or things that people had to do in understanding, wow, we have data that we need? Because you can feel like, oh, we got diagrams. That's great. Like, in some hand, people can feel like the information exists in the system, in the organization, but it's not usable. So how did you walk people through? It's like, this is important, so the information is usable.
Yeah, I think that was... trying to get to that state was a very easy sell, like on the vision. Imagine that, because most of the people that we were selling to, if we're trying to work with the local site and you're working with the site management, site leadership, or you're working with some of the global manufacturing executive teams, they all have been there. And so they get it. But the challenge wasn't, okay, can you contextualize this process properly? Because everybody at one point had probably done it in Excel or on some legal pad or a napkin. But one of the things, the challenge for us was, oh, what's the effort to do that? Because they're thinking, okay, I have 50 or 100,000 instruments and you want to know exactly how, you want to know this flow meter and you want to know if it's, which boiler it's attached to, is it, and what's the material feed and all this other metadata information about it and how much effort that one would take. And then you multiply that by 100,000.
Yeah.
And you're like, we have a plant to run and we have to produce product for our customers.
Yeah.
And so that was a pretty massive challenge that a lot of effort went into just the creation of the program to build this. We use a lot of agile sprint methodologies and a lot of effort on just aligning resources and trying to have a repeatable process to deliver this massive scope of work without causing any major disruptions to our normal day-to-day jobs.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, like, in trying to in seek of continuous improvement, it can also feel like yet another job if you're not careful. But that leads into the next question I have, which is around you have a big vision, and then you have very subject matter expert leadership, right? They can quickly calculate, as you said, calculate. I understand what you're saying, and I understand the values. Oh my gosh, the dollars are adding up quick to get there. So how do you balance, or how did y'all balance quick wins with long-term strategic thinking? Because cast a big picture, we can see the value, but then it's still risky chasing like all the incremental costs to then get to that value. So how did you balance delivering some near-term ROI or casting the picture of delivering ROI when it can feel far away with the big picture you're putting out there?
Yeah, so I think this is where pilots are helpful.
Yeah. So back to pilots.
But avoid the purgatory side of it.
Yes.
I was lucky that early on at the time that I got into this in my career for trying to create the global scope of work, mm-hmm. we already had enough of these pilot purgatory examples already happening in the company. So mm-hmm. we had lots of examples of the technology mm-hmm. and being able to prove it. And then in some cases, we actually had some cases where there was, you know, real business value. So we built a plan for, okay, if we combine all these different technologies and methods into one global solution, then, and we look and compare it, the ROI that the previous ones had, we could extrapolate that out and say, this is what it's worth. And there's a fairly large range for that. And so that gave us enough of a business case to get started. And so we did this in a formal project process. So we mm-hmm. have like an evaluation period to, mm-hmm. you know, here's your range of where you think the economics are. And then you start to design it. And normally if you're building like a brand new chemical plant, mm-hmm. you might actually, when you design the process, you might actually start to develop the drawings. And then maybe you're starting to then go and actually build some of the equipment. And for us, what we did is our design was the pilot. So we started with the pilot. We had this high level economics and we started to put these pieces together. Mm-hmm. But also during that pilot, we also piloted the resource burden in this process that we were creating. So we were piloting technology at the same time with the whole process to build it. And so at the end of that pilot, we could say, okay, the technology works. It does what we say it is going to do.
Yeah.
And then this is the cost from a resource perspective. And here's the whole business case. And then we were able to make decisions on how and what pace do we want to execute. And so that was a strategy that we took. And based on that early pilot, we actually changed some of our direction of which manufacturing sites we were going to work yeah. at in what order, because maybe some at different periods of time couldn't spare the resources and yeah. it would be too much of a burden. So that's the approach that we took.
Yeah. So if I'm hearing that, like it was, and this is going to sound funny for people in manufacturing to say that, oh, but we had to put a process around doing innovation, right? But in some cases, when you took a survey of all the pilots that had happened, there wasn't a process per se around it. Like it was a lot of great activity happening in the org, but because there was a missing connection between what was the value, how do we think about scaling this, like defining value, but then defining the ROI on that. As you said, the resource burden is important because most things we can innovate on will provide value. It's just, as to your point, is what's the cost to get that? And are we going to scale the return on that? If we can't scale the return on that, then maybe it's a good idea, but for later, right? It's, I think what was one economist back in the 80s that's driven a lot of thinking. It's like waste what's abundant, right? We don't have a lot of time, but waste what's abundant. And so certain things, like certain pilots are going to show, here's an abundant resource, right? Like in this case, data and ML. I can apply something to it and get like a really strong return. Here's another thing that's going to require a lot of people to do.
Right.
The data says it's going to require a lot of people. People aren't necessarily abundant and time's not abundant. Like, we can't do that. So I think that what I'm hearing is y'all put some process around the innovation. It didn't have to be heavy, but it's what's the value? You know, what would be the cost to scale this? Where can we fit this in?
Right.
And that to me, I see that over and over when people don't think about at least lightweight putting that in, then you get stuck in pilot purgatory, because then you can never, if you can't answer those questions coming out of your pilot, you know, what as the executive, what am I signing up for?
Right.
I'm not going to sign off on you doing more. All right. So I love that. So then culture, change management, and organizational buy-in. Why, for you, why do these soft factors matter just as much, if not more, than the tech stack? You've hinted at a little bit already, but just let me ask the direct question. Just hit it on the nose there.
Yeah, I can't speak more about the importance of change management. It's, I'd say, the most important thing. And I think it's better to have a subpar technology stack and effort with great change management than the other way around.
I agree 100%.
And so. Technical people don't like to hear that. And when I started it, I didn't want to hear that. You would think, if you build the perfect technology, then people will just magically adopt it. So I always had this picture of, and you've probably seen it before, of the two cavemen, and one of them's holding a round wheel and the other one's pulling a cart with a square wheel. Yeah. And he's, hey, I got this new thing for you. And the guy's, I'm sorry, I'm too busy. I don't have time.
Yeah.
And I don't have any tattoos, but if I did have a tattoo, that would be one, and I'd put it right here on my chest.
Yeah, nice.
Because it's a big challenge, but it's really fascinating. And so I think over the past maybe 2 or 3 or 4 years, I've switched from me focusing my efforts on the technology to that people side and the change side.
Yeah.
Organizational change. And it's pretty challenging. And one of the things that we use is we use a methodology, because we're in manufacturing, we like our processes.
Yep.
So we use the ProSci ADCAR methodology.
Okay. Yep.
And so ADCAR stands for, let's see if I can get it right, awareness, desire, knowledge, action, and reinforcement.
Yep. I'm saying yep like I know, and I don't remember either. So I'm glad you said it.
Yeah. And maybe I fumbled one of those, but you get the general sense. Mm-hmm. And so for us, on the awareness side, I think we were pretty good at that. That's where you get into marketing and communications and kind of sharing that global vision, building some initial excitement. I think the desire piece is one that we struggled with, because for us, if we look at this, of how many people we are influencing, it's thousands of people across multiple countries. It's multiple different languages, and they all have different needs. So, you know, you're going to, an operator, manufacturing operator in China is wanting something different out of his day job than an operator in North America or an engineer in Australia. And so that is one. And to be honest, I don't know if we'll ever solve that one, but I think we definitely we didn't put enough effort in understanding that and then crafting a solution to help solve that, create that desire for people and make that more apparent globally.
No, I think that's an insightful piece there, because it is hard, because as you mentioned, particularly with the more cultures, the more, heck, you know, cultures are just different even between states here. Like, you know, you start to, and then, you know, you go to India and it's not only the different states and it's a huge place, but then the different cultures across the states, different languages across the states. It's just amazing what you can run into when you're looking at that organizational change. But
we find it within the same city at the same manufacturing site, you'll have multiple product lines and different control rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And there's massive culture differences if you're working in this control room versus this control room.
Yeah.
And then within that, let's say you're all making the same product, and you're all in the same control room, we operate 24/7. So you have multiple shifts, and A shift will have a completely different culture than C shift.
Yeah.
And so trying to figure that out globally is unbelievably challenging.
Yes. Yeah. It's the problem we're solving, though.
And it is.
But as you say, the awareness piece is the big thing, right? It's the first step. And I know IDCAR only has 5 steps, but there's many different programs where awareness is the first thing, right?
Right.
And so you have to have that awareness first, that this is an important problem we're solving and that it is something we're spending time on. Awesome. Jonathan, you've now worked on, tell you about the process for building pilot purgatory, getting out of pilot purgatory, attaching one of the big things that y'all did in the early stages, how do we attach business value? How do we know the cost in pursuing this thing so that we can look roughly at the ROI? And as you mentioned, timing is also important, right? Because it's sometimes if you have an awareness and desire, but they might not have the capacity, like you just mentioned in that plant, right? So that's also an important thing is knowing. It's even if you have awareness and desire for that thing, it's if they're going through, I don't know, maybe just say they're doing an upgrade or something like that,
right?
Changing out equipment, there's just no capacity to do these things. So that's also having that empathy for where your target audience or your target improvement is. They just right idea, wrong time, right? Let's figure out. So I think that's another important insight. But your framework that you put allowed y'all to think about those questions, pilot, and then know when the right time to deploy a pilot or the right place to deploy a pilot. But in close, now that you've done this for a while, what's one myth or silver kind of bullet mindset that you would like to bust or just wish would go away when it comes with achieving ROI with AI?
I say we talked about change management and as people, I'm a previous process engineer and most engineers like things to be black and white and come to a conclusion and an end. And when you're dealing with people, I don't know that there will ever be that. And so even if you follow the right change management strategy, culture eats strategy for breakfast, the age old saying.
Yep.
So I'll end with a personal story. Just recently, so I'm originally from Louisiana. I've lived in Houston, Texas for the last 15 years, but gumbo is a big part of our family tradition.
Okay.
So my wife actually for the last 10 years or so has made a big pot of gumbo almost every Sunday night. Mm-hmm. And so I have 3 kids, 2 girls that are 7 and 4 and then a 7-month-old. And getting kids to eat anything is an act of God or an act of Congress.
Oh, I can testify.
Yeah. And so gumbo is my favorite food on the planet. I just love it, which is why we have it every week.
Yeah.
And giving a little kid a bowl of gumbo is just expecting them to eat it. They don't like it because everything's touching. They don't like things to touch. So we had to separate the rice and separate the chicken and separate the sausage. And even then trying to get them to eat that was challenging.
Yep.
So I've been thinking over the years, how do I get them to eat this gumbo? And actually a couple months ago, I came up and I got a solution. All I had to do was take their bowl of gumbo and just sprinkle a few goldfish on top. Yeah. And all kids love goldfish. But as soon as I did that, they devoured it and they ate the whole bowl, both girls. And then the oldest actually asked for seconds, which doesn't happen very often. And it kind of made me think when you're thinking about change management or trying to end your pilot purgatory, you're going to have all these different strategies and systems that you're going to put in place. But at the end of the day, you can't try to figure out everything. And you're just going to have to be agile and flexible and change where the process is heading and adapt to the cultures and the challenges that you're dealt with. And you're going to have to sometimes be clever. You're going to have to figure out ways to find your own goldfish and sprinkle them in. And so that would be my biggest piece of advice, is that you just have to be persistent and you have to keep trying things, and you can't be fixed in your processes and your ways and trying to adapt and change over time.
Yeah. So don't be surprised if we title this episode, Find Your Goldfish.
Yeah, Find Your Goldfish.
Yes. Any parent listening to this podcast can probably relate. And I can tell you now, my kids are my goldfish are wet.
I have had that happen, okay? you can't have soggy goldfish. So you gotta make sure you sprinkle it in right before they take their first bite.
Oh yeah.
And then sometimes you have to have a few kind of refreshers. So you sprinkle a few in and you let them eat for a while, then you keep it. You don't want
keep
the soggy
fresh.
Goldfish.
Yeah, yeah, don't want the soggy goldfish. Jonathan, appreciate your time today. Thank you for sharing your insights.
Yeah,
it's fantastic
absolutely.
Having you on.
Yeah, thanks so much, Sidney.